Now, some answers to your questions about the standoff between the U.S. and North Korea. Last week, we asked you to phone in your questions, and today we're going to answer a few of them with the help of two people. Ambassador Wendy Sherman, a former special advisor on North Korea during the Clinton administration, is now a partner in the Albright Group, an international consulting firm. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Ambassador, glad to be Sherman. Here.
And we also have Donald Oberdorfer, professor at the Johns Hopkins Nitze School of Advanced International Studies and author of the book Two Koreas, A Contemporary History. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, Robert.
Let's start with one of the most frequent questions listeners had. It's about the 1994 agreement that the U.S. made with North Korea.
My name is Bob Allen. I'm an English teacher in South Korea. My question is regarding the 1994 agreement where I believe the American government promised to build two nuclear reactors for North Korea if they agreed to halt their nuclear weapons program. I'd like to know why those reactors were never completed. The North Korean government and many South Koreans point to the fact that by failing to build those nuclear reactors, the American government violated and, in essence, nullified the agreement. I'd like to know if that's an accurate depiction or not.
Wendy Sherman, is the Korean version that Bob Allen quotes accurate or not?
It's not quite accurate. In fact, it was a consortium that was put together of the United States, South Korea, and Japan. And we all thought that the reactors might be in place as early as 2003 this year. It actually turned out to be a much more complicated undertaking than anyone imagined, starting off with getting South Korea and Japan to agree on the financing, because the United States isn't putting up the money, South Korea and Japan are. And that took a little bit longer than everybody expected. Then it took longer to get the labor in place and the agreements in place to move forward. So the whole project turned out to be a very complicated legal, financial, and construction. You know, we've all worked with contractors in the past, and sometimes we know it doesn't go exactly how we expected. So I think there's probably some fault all the way around here.
Don Oberdorfer, was there also fault on the part of the North Koreans?
Yes, there was. When I was in Pyongyang in early November, they were complaining about the slowness of this project. And I pointed out to them that some of the slowness is due to their own actions. As Wendy mentioned a minute ago, there was a dispute about how to pay or how much to pay the workers. And the dispute was not really solved. The United States and the people who were actually building the reactors had to bring in Uzbekistan people to work on it. And however, the concrete has been poured. There was work going on. There are, as I understand it, about 1,000 people actually in this site in North Korea building the reactors, or have been up until now. So it's not quite fair to say that nothing has happened, although it has taken longer than anyone expected.
Okay, the next question is for Don Oberdorfer, and it is about what we know about the internal workings of the North Korean government.
This is Alan Eisenberg of Manalapan, New Jersey. My question is, what certainty do we have that Kim Jong-il is actually in control in North Korea? There have been questions in the past whether he had truly taken over his father's hold on the country. Is, in fact, the country run by a group of octogenarian generals? And who's really calling the shots in North Korea?
What do you think?
Well, I think we can say with some certainty that he is in charge in North Korea. When Secretary Albright went to North Korea toward the end of the year 2000, and Wendy Sherman was with her, the person who she negotiated with was none other than Kim Jong-il, and he was ready to give answers about their positions. The same is true of the South Koreans and others who have been up to North Korea on important occasions. We don't know a lot about how their government actually works, but what we do know suggests that it's very much a one-man show, that he makes the decisions, other people carry them out.
Wendy Sherman, the next question is also about the politics of North Korea. Why don't you handle this one?
My name is Anna Choi, and I live in New Orleans, Louisiana. My question, are the Korean people favorable to the regime, or do they know how bad the regime is? And if they do know, what is the chance of a mass movement to force the leadership out? And if not, why is this so?
And we assume Ms. Joyce is talking about the North Korean public and the regime in Pyongyang.
Yes. North Korea has a moniker that's often used in the press as the Hermit Kingdom. And the reason is because it's very isolated and very closed off from the rest of the world. Chairman Kim Jong-il told us he has the internet, but I think it's fair to say that virtually everybody else does not, nor is there television, nor are there people who come in and out of the country in an easy fashion. And so most of the people in North Korea, at least to the extent that people have traveled around and been able to speak with them, believe that all good things come from Kim Jong-il, that he is really in many ways the son of God, with his father being God. It is really a very tightly knit society, and I think to a large extent the kind of opposition movements that we've seen in the former Soviet Union, in other countries moving to democracy, do not exist in North Korea. There are some underground movements, some missionaries who have tried to find their way in, some work along the border with China, but for the most part, this is the country, a country where if a transition ever comes, it's going to be slow and very, very difficult.
The next question is about North Korean military capabilities.
My name is Paul Flogger. I'm calling from Cincinnati, Ohio. I have read about North Korea as being capable of delivering a devastating first strike, but I wonder, are they really capable of doing that? And if they do, how well could they follow up and hold any land they gain?
Presumably a strike against South Korea.
Well, they're capable, certainly, of attacking South Korea. They have a large number of troops, usually estimated around 1 million, some of whom are very close to the border with South Korea, the so-called demilitarized zone. And they are within artillery range of Seoul, the biggest city in South Korea, the capital of South Korea. They're certainly capable of attacking through conventional means. They're believed to have quite a store of chemical weapons. They might have biological weapons. The estimates are that they are capable of having produced nuclear weapons, but we don't know that they actually have. Could they follow up? Well, they have a very large army, as I said, but it is not a very well-equipped army by modern standards. The commander of U.S. Forces Korea at the time of the 1994 crisis, General Luck, said, "I can win this war for you. I just can't win it right away."
Well, the next question is about the international context of the North Korean crisis. And this is the question that I would have asked. So, Wendy Sherman, I may have follow up this one.
My name is Donna Markward, and I'm from Ripon, Wisconsin. My question is, does anyone see any relationship between Korea's defiance of the nuclear regulations and the U.S.'s engagement in the conflict in Iraq and the war on terrorism? In other words, seeing the United States in a weakened state, people can act up.
Total coincidence of timing, or is there some relationship that you see here?
I don't think it's a coincidence at all. I think the listener is quite perceptive. I think that North Korea saw that they had a moment here around a few events. First, the war in Iraq that we were very focused on at the United States. We were preoccupied with it. We didn't want anything to get in the way of it. And they're trying to precipitate a crisis. The North Koreans, that is, at this moment, gave them some additional leverage. I also think they were looking at the South Korean election. South Korea just elected a new president that takes office later in February. And I think, again, Chairman Kim Jong-il saw this as a good time to try to create a wedge between our two countries as a new South Korean president was trying to define the policy toward North Korea. So I think they're very keen about events going on in the world and see it as an important moment.
Don Oberdorfer, do you have a dissenting view?
Yes, I do. I don't think they precipitated this crisis. I mean, what precipitated the crisis was the U.S. discovery that they have a highly enriched uranium project in violation, certainly, of the spirit of the 1994 agreement and of the Nonproliferation Treaty as well.
But didn't they discover that when a North Korean official suddenly told them?
No. The U.S. intelligence discovered that sometime over the summer. I say discovered it. Mm-hmm. There had been indications for a long time that they had such a program, but some sort of smoking gun evidence was acquired over the summer, and in October, Assistant Secretary Jim Kelly went to North Korea, said, "We know you have this program." And they are now saying they didn't flat out admit it, but they said to Assistant Secretary Kelly, "We are entitled to have this program of nuclear weapons." And the U.S. interpreted that and other remarks as an admission that they did have it. So then, after that, a whole train of events set into motion. So it was not precipitated by them, in my opinion.
It developed according to its own timetable.
It developed according to a timetable in which Iraq is a factor.
Okay, here's another question.
My name is Chad Folsom. I live in Hermosa Beach, California. And I have two questions. My first question is, what does North Korea hope to gain from building up their nuclear arms program and having sort of a militant stance against negotiations? And my other question is, how can the United States government be so holier than thou? I guess I wonder what the root of the U.S. government's policy as far as not allowing nuclear proliferation while we have nuclear weapons.
Wendy Sherman, first, what do you understand to be the North Koreans' aims in the current crisis?
I think it's very hard to discern North Korea's intentions, so I'll speculate along with everybody else, maybe a little educated speculation. I think that what they want more than anything is for their regime to survive. They see it absolutely crucial to get security assurances from the United States that we will not attack them. They see us calling them part of the axis of evil. They see us beginning probably a war with Iraq. They saw us bombing Yugoslavia. They don't want to be next. They think we're the only country left on the face of the earth that really could take them out. I think in terms of the caller's second point, the question about whether we can be holier than thou, there are a number of nuclear weapons countries. It's why the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was created, for those countries first who signed onto it were those who were the nuclear powers, and then I guess we're up to about 187 countries have signed on. And the idea is to control, have transparency in your nuclear program, and for those countries who are not nuclear yet, to not become nuclear. So we totally understand that we must deaccelerate and we must rid the world of nuclear weapons.
Well, thanks to both of you for coming here to answer our listeners' questions about the U.S.-Korea crisis. Wendy Sherman, former special advisor on North Korea during the Clinton administration, and Donald Oberdorfer, author of Two Koreas, A Contemporary History. Again, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Well, I hope we were able to answer some questions.